a conversation with Morris Andrews.
Okay.
So in 1972, you arrived.
In 1972, when the teachers started, they created a political action committee. And for the first time, they started endorsing candidates. And from 1972 to 1992, public schools went from the fourth largest expenditure of state government to the first number one expenditure of state government, and they were so far ahead of the others that it didn't, that, I mean, it was tripling.
Right, exactly. And how did, what did it take to do that?
It took that the teachers had to have a political entity, and and they had to start endorsing candidates who had a voting record on behalf of public education. And at that, in that period of time, WEAC endorsed a lot of Republicans and a lot of Democrats.
This was the 70s and 80s.
That's right. And in addition to those kinds of things about school funding, Wisconsin has more than 50% of its schools, even today, have 1,000 students or less, right. K-12.
Lots of small ones, yeah.
So it has lots of small school districts. Those school districts in the 70s, 50 of them or more offered no foreign language in the high school. Zero.
Nothing.
And they had no remedial education program that they were teaching to students who couldn't, whose reading scores were below.
Right.
And there weren't advanced math, advanced English, advanced science classes. There were not a common standard for how many credits you had to have to graduate. There was just a whole range of things that varied. So the teachers' union said, wait a minute, this makes no sense. And we passed time after time standards that all school districts had to meet. So that even in these rural small school districts, kids had some common standard.
And this was through DPI?
No, it was through the state legislature.
The legislature, right. But the DPI was the vehicle to...
The DPI administered the laws, and they're through administrative rules carried them out.
Right.
Now, and in that period of time, starting in the late 70s through the 90s, Wisconsin's public schools had the highest scores in the nation for 15 or 20 or 25 years on ACT test scores. Now, in Wisconsin always had a much larger proportion of students who were tested than other states.
Other states, right.
And this is while Milwaukee was whatever Milwaukee is.
Right.
We used to take the scores from all the private parochial schools, aggregate them because they sent them to the department, compare them to the public schools, and there was never a year in those 20 years when the when the Catholic school system in the aggregate was even close to the public schools on the ACD test scores. Now,
so what was the impetus in 1972 for teachers to organize in this manner, and for you to you know, be there to drive this?
What happened? Because teachers, for years, weren't listened to. The superintendent, in most cases, did what he wanted, or and it was a he, because there weren't women.
Right, back then, yeah.
And the teachers were tired of it. And so they wanted a voice. Not unlike most groups. Not unlike nurses in hospitals today.
You know, doctors, whatever the AMA,
right.
Exactly.
So,
but what? So there must have been a key group of people. I mean, you have to have leadership, obviously, and then you have to have the ability to get the money, you know, to make these things happen. I mean, was
well,
it just
you
enough?
Also have you also have situations where there were Governor Tommy Thompson's wife taught in Elroy.
Right.
She had taught 30 years. had a master's degree, and when Tommy was governor, you know, Sue Ann used to say, I don't make $30,000 a year.
Right.
And Tommy, Morris is right and you're wrong, mm-hmm. that you need to pay teachers better wages. Mm-hmm. Now, in those years, in lots of these rural schools, mm-hmm. that most of the teachers were women.
Yes.
Their husband was the bank president, mm-hmm. or he owned a business in town, mm-hmm. or he was a big farmer. Mm-hmm. And the women were the brightest and best because what occupations could a woman go to?
Teaching and nurses. My mom's a nurse, yeah.
And a secretary.
Right.
So in those professions, mm-hmm. Teaching was clearly had advantages over being a nurse or a secretary. Mm-hmm. And you didn't have, teachers, women couldn't be doctors or dentists.
Right.
Exactly. Or accountants, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. Now, so the academic background and performance of teachers, women teachers mm-hmm. in particular, was extraordinarily higher than most other occupations. Mm-hmm. Today, nobody's talking about the ticking time bomb about what's going to happen to schools, because today, those same quality of people aren't going into schools.
I just talked to a retired teacher in Chicago the other night. Her daughter is quite talented, and the advisor at their high school said, well, you're too bright for that. That's amazing. Yeah.
So, so who's going to replace these teachers
exactly.
is going to be people of lesser
absolutely
academic background yeah. and prowess.
Yes.
And I don't think that's the only thing that aids, but I don't think that having the kind of drop off that's going to happen here bodes well for schools.
Yeah, agreed.
And so these were bright people mm-hmm. whose husbands were in the power structure mm-hmm. of these communities, mm-hmm. and they were sick and tired of the way they were treated.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the superintendent at the school board.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because a former superintendent here mentioned to me that he thought in Madison, anyway, there wasn't enough balance between the chamber and the business community and the public sector. And he said other cities in the state, they're more interested, they're more engaged in these issues. You know, is that important to, as you say, you know, you're talking to Tommy Thompson, is that important to have more engagement amongst these different groups in education? I mean, was that a factor in your 20-year run of growth? And
what is your, I don't know. What specific question are you asking me?
Well, if you don't have enough engagement on the part of, let's say, the business community or the university community or what, you know, the bigger players in town. You know, let's compare Madison to Green Bay or Milwaukee or Wausau or Eau Claire or Austin, Texas or what have you. You know, if there's a vacuum in one of those, you mentioned like the bank president's wife, if the bank president is not a factor, doesn't care, you know, does that then dilute the support for the schools or the interest in the financial part of it? Or, you know, is that one of the issues that...
If you don't have all the major constituencies mm-hmm. Interested, I think it has... probably consequences because their voices aren't going to be heard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, in most rural these school districts I was talking about, mm-hmm. This biggest single occupation of farmers was being a teacher. Mm-hmm. Their wife,
yeah.
Because in those days, farming didn't pay enough money.
No, that's right.
So that the wife had to work at a yeah. job that they could bring home some cash,
right?
So that they could afford
mm-hmm.
To make that farm work
right.
Economically.
Completely different today. You
yes.
know, there's big farms and a few small farms, and that's
right.
it. Yeah. So the culture that you were part of, let's say the petri dish you were part of for those 20 years, has really changed both politically and the economic part of that, obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. So when you think about that 20-year run, what would you say were the top couple things that you accomplished? What was, you know, if you look back and say, yeah, that was those two or three things, and then those are things we should think about for the next 10 or 20.
Well, I think teachers were consistently a voice that brought forth legislative proposals that improved the quality of schools, large and small, statewide. And over that time, we narrowed the gap so that there couldn't be such huge differences between school districts. Mm-hmm. That we cut the parameters down.
So that was the grand bargain with the two-thirds funding and all that. Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
But there also was this state has always had a culture that drinking was really important. Mm-hmm. The most difficult single bill we ever passed at WEAC was raising the drinking age so that you couldn't drink beer at age 18. our opponents were not Republicans, but more Democrats who said, well, if you're old enough to serve in the Army, you're old enough to drink. And a third to a half of seniors in high school could drink. Mm-hmm. So we by raising the drinking age to 19 in 21, we forced alcohol out of the schools. Mm-hmm. And in this culture, alcohol is a big, long-term societal problem.
Yes.
So that was probably the most singly difficult issue we ever passed through the legislature. Wow. The only way we did it was we ran radio ads against some Democrats who were opposed to the bill in rural districts and really made it uncomfortable for them. Mm-hmm. And superintendents and principals were with us. So that was a big issue.
Interesting.
A second big issue was that the large school districts, including Madison, there were 47, 50 school districts, mm-hmm. where the school district was fiscally dependent on the city council.
Oh, right. Yeah,
for
yeah.
the passing of
right,
its budget.
Right, yes.
So we passed a law that took away the power of municipalities to approve school district budgets.
Interesting. Why? What was the impetus?
Well, because you could... what the hell is the purpose of the city government deciding what the school district can spend?
Of course, it's in vogue now, you know, for some mayors to come back in and get quite involved in schools.
Well, but that may be a different issue than how much should you spend. Mm-hmm. So that was another issue that really freed up the school districts, because a lot of these school districts, Beloit, you know, Janesville, Wisconsin Rapids, these municipalities really played hardball about school district budgets. A fourth issue was that the Wisconsin WIAA, the State High School Athletic Association, there were in 1970, sex discrimination in school athletics resulted in 14, on the average at the time, there were 14 boys' athletic programs in the typical high school.
Sure.
At the same time, there were 6 programs for girls.
Right.
We sued the WIAA and the State Superintendent of Public Instruction that their rules and behavior was discriminatory against girls. Mm-hmm. They didn't even have state... Girls didn't have a state high school basketball.
Yeah. I believe.
And now everybody accepts that girls have equal sports programs.
Sure.
I don't know how you could overstate the change that being competitive in high school sports would make for girls versus what it was back then.
In just 4 years.
And so...
What did it take to pass that?
It took a lawsuit. We threatened a suit, and then we picked out superintendents who were on the school, on the WIAA and principals, and went after them in their local communities. But those things didn't just happen.
Well, you need somebody to develop the strategy.
Well, yes, but... And so today, my point here is, I would say that none of those things could you point to and say, this really just helps the teachers.
No, no.
I mean, this fundamentally helps kids, the state, and education. Now when you render the union to not be able to have money and the ability to organize, you're gonna have, there's gonna be no voice in the legislative political process to bring about this kind of change.
So tell me how the legislature has changed over the years. And I'm only asking,
I don't think you could overstate what kind of changes are going to happen because...
that's what I'm getting at with my questions about the legislature.
But you see, people who have power never voluntarily give it up. No. So superintendents and school boards, my point isn't they're bad people, but they want to prevail.
Sure.
Now they have just gotten handed back to them the power that existed pre-1972.
Right.
So now they're going to do this the way they want to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them are pretty smart and will see the broader picture. Some of them, like most people, want life to be comfortable.
Right.
So, you know, you can't assume that just because they're a superintendent or a school board member, that every decision they're going to make is through the prism, is this the best choice on behalf of the children of our community?
A professor friend and I were involved in some reading issues at the state level a couple of years ago. Wisconsin's adopted Massachusetts content knowledge rules for elementary teachers. And I remember talking to some of the legislatures and state senators during that process, and they were often puzzled about the right thing to do for education. And my question to you is, you know, when you talk to these people over the years, you know, are you dealing with thoughtful politicians? Are you dealing with pure self-interest? Are you dealing with just people who want to be there because of the job, the benefits, the glamour, or whatever that is? You know, how has that changed?
All of the above.
All of the above.
But my experience... I don't think that the current ideological movement in politics to having the extremes of liberals and conservatives is in the society's interest. Mm-hmm. And it used to be, if you wanted to know... If you wanted to deal with the legislators, Republicans or Democrats, a lot after the day was over, you'd find a lot of both of them out eating and drinking together.
Right.
Today, both parties somewhat view the other party as the enemy.
Yeah.
And that's probably more true, in my view, at the federal level than it is at the state level, but I think it's seeping down.
Sure, sure. It's flowing downhill, of course.
I think that less and less of this is let's solve our problems. Mm-hmm. I think the greatest thing that this country ever decided was to have universal public education. Mm-hmm. We were the first country in the world.
Absolutely.
Now, Walker and these Republicans are after eliminating public education because they have now created a funding system and a system. They're now spending better than $250 million a year paying for parents like you to send your kids to a Catholic school system. Mm-hmm. You can't take $250 million out of the public system and not have consequences. Mm-hmm. And so he's trying to starve the public school system to death. And the guys is, well, Milwaukee isn't good, and we have some other bad places, mm-hmm. so we need to threaten them and give parents an alternative. Mm-hmm. Well, if that was really true, then you'd have testing and accountability standards that were identical for these private schools.
Agreed.
To the public schools.
They're getting public money, absolutely. So then why is Minnesota more successful?
Interesting.
Academically, anyway. And actually, financially, they spend a little less per student than we do.
Well, Wisconsin's kids have never... I don't know about today,
yeah.
but when I was at WEAC...
Yeah, actually, you're exactly right. A friend of mine has been following this. Late 80s is when it started to change, where Minnesota continued to improve and we did not. And in Minnesota's case, you know, they have teacher content requirements, which some people point to as, well, that's decisive. I don't know. And then they also have, obviously, they were the first charter environment, both with unions and without. It's interesting to me that you have these different...
But see, I don't think these charter schools or these competition things, if you want to bring about change in a public school,
yeah, how do you?
I think you decide that you're going to just head at the issue straight on. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the biggest fights we had in the legislature was that at the time, in the middle 70s, in the early 80s, in Wisconsin, you could get an early elementary teaching certificate and have 4 credits in reading or information and knowledge about how to teach reading. Mm-hmm. And we had just a brawl with the university. Every university dean of the School of Education opposed this. Mm-hmm. When Bert Grover was the superintendent,
sure.
we required that if you're going to have an early elementary degree, that you had to have a minor in reading,
right.
to get a certificate.
Yes.
Now, any person in the world would think that giving the importance to academic success of reading,
yes.
that you'd have to have more than 2 credits,
right.
or 2 courses in reading.
Yeah.
And so I think if you take these issues head on, mm-hmm. and deal with them, but you have people who have all other agendas. Mm-hmm. Walker's agenda isn't to reform schools. I mean, is he opposed to that? No, but he wants rid of his political enemies, mm-hmm. and the biggest, strongest political enemies that he had were teachers.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So he wants to rid the society of them. Mm-hmm. I think evidence of that is that he wants, when it comes to it. What purpose eliminating same-day registration? Mm-hmm. What purpose eliminating rules that you can vote before the election? And all these...
Oh, yeah, the 51% thing, right. and all that stuff, sure.
And so all those things that made Wisconsin have a much higher... had the second highest consistently proportion of people voting. Mm-hmm. Now, you know... Because they Republicans believe that turns out groups who tend to vote Democratic. Mm-hmm. They don't want them voting.
Right, there's a turnout battle. There's no question. There's no question. So, what led? So now we think about 92. What led to where we, you know, where Walker was elected? Where I think I sent you a link, the $1.5 million for 4 senators. You know, that we spent in 2010. How did the unions get to that point? Was it just leadership change? Was it, you know, had their sway along? I mean, is it like any organization? You know, you're rolling along. How did we get to that point? You talked about
I think lots of things happened. I think that you had in that period of time, the UAW membership in Wisconsin went from 500,000 or 600,000 members to 200.
Oh yeah, big change. Yeah.
And so there was this growth in the public sector, but there was an enormous, and the paper makers and right. the paper unions mm-hmm. went down enormously. Mm-hmm. So I think you saw a very, very significant reduction
beer companies, right.
in mm-hmm. in unions in the private sector. Mm-hmm. And you saw a very significant, until the 80s, probably the late 80s, the realtors didn't have a PAC. Mm-hmm. The WMC didn't have a PAC. Mm-hmm. The Farm Bureau didn't have a PAC. Mm-hmm. The, you know, the Restaurant Association didn't have a PAC.
So you had a wider berth for a while.
Well, and they all saw, they aren't stupid,
right,
they
right.
saw what results mm-hmm. people who had political action committees sure. had. So, you know, they sought to change the power balance. Mm-hmm. Now, the only group that was here in 1972 and probably would have been number one and still is number one is the road builders.
Yeah. Yes. Very effective lobby.
But they have one very different thing. Almost every nickel spent on roads comes from the state, the federal government, the counties, the cities, the towns, the villages. Mm-hmm. So just by necessity, they understand that they have to be involved in government.
And all that, yeah.
And, you know, so you have all that. So I think you've seen lots of shifting in the power mm-hmm. in the state.
Definitely. Yeah, healthcare is a big factor now. Huge factor, yeah.
The university is almost inept.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The chart that I have, I think it was from WISTEX, showed the K-12 spending growth from, as I said, 83 to 97, and the UW was flatline. So I was shocked. Yeah, amazing. Amazing. So why is that? I mean, they're just not organized. They don't have a good leader. Or, you know, or they turn over people too fast. Or, I mean, 20 years, that's pretty.
Well, I think that one thing that's happened to the university is that they have had a lot of people who have changed positions as chancellors mm-hmm. and presidents. So you have a lot of people who came to Wisconsin and took over those positions. Mm-hmm. Who had no idea about the Wisconsin idea mm-hmm. and the culture. Mm-hmm. And they came from New York State, or they came from Texas, or they came from whatever state. Mm-hmm. So the culture in the university changed enormously. Because you didn't have the top coming from inside.
You didn't have the grassroots, yeah.
And I think the other two things that happened that are enormously important is the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, mm-hmm. the two newspapers, and the Cap Times. Mm-hmm. Those three papers used to be the moral conscience of this state. Mm-hmm. And they used to be read by 60%
right.
of the voters. Mm-hmm. Today, the Milwaukee Journal and the Sentinel are one paper. Mm-hmm. And when it came time to pass a bond referendum to build the new Brewer Stadium, mm-hmm. the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel acted as allies and cheerleaders for that.
Of course.
Rather than being the moral conscience
the fourth estate.
of what was... significant on a value basis.
Sure.
So I think we no longer have
a fourth estate.
Our moral conscience, and thus I think we have an ever-deteriorating collective value of what's acceptable politically in this state.
So is there, I want to dump on that a little more, because I agree completely the decline of, I should say the fragmentation of media has all sorts of issues all over the place. So what is the solution?
See, I'm trying to say that the Journal Sentinel acts more like a business.
No question.
Than they do like the newspaper.
Right, a fourth estate. Yeah, yes. Somebody investigates, asks questions, enlightens. I grew up reading newspapers. I love good news, and things have changed dramatically. There's no question about that. So what, you know, if you were coming into this today, you know, how would you get the word out? How would you build awareness and influence? You know, what, I mean, what, you know, I don't believe it's just Facebook and all that. I just can't believe it. But what would you do?
Well, I think that the other thing that's happened, it used to be, when I came to Wisconsin, Ray Majerus, who was the regional director for the UAW.
Oh, yeah, the father.
Called me up and said, Morris, if you would like some help, I'd be more than willing to sit down with you and have a conversation periodically and help you. Probably 4 or 5 times a year, we'd have supper, breakfast, or lunch. I knew probably 40 or 50 of the top power actors. I knew the guy. I knew the guy and could do business with the executive secretary of the Milwaukee Chamber. I knew Paul Hassett, who was the executive secretary of the manufacturers.
Sure.
I knew the guy who was the president of the Farm Bureau. We knew each other.
So the relationship.
We had a relationship that we knew that you could trust each other.
Right.
And we weren't strangers if one of us called the other person about some issue.
This issue, sure.
After I left, WEAC hired some people that I don't think understood power. I don't think are the most radical, ideological people I've ever seen in control of government. And they're willing to push through what they, the changes they want, and let the chips fall where they may. And I think, I don't think people understand, they aren't just tinkering around the edges of the system.
So, I guess to Carrie's point into our earlier, how would you today, so there's relationships, right, but in terms of the role that the large-scale media used to have with, as you say, 60% of the voters reading these things, I'm going to start recording again. There we go. So with the decline of these big media engines where 60% of the popular voters would read it, is there a way to fill that void? How would you build awareness in 2013 and beyond?
Well, I think you have to. I think you have to have some moral voice about the state's culture, I think you need to introduce some vehicle that doesn't exist today, because I think the media has they've gotten kind of pulled off the side about being money changers. Mm-hmm. And so I think you're going to have to come up with some other vehicle.
Something new. Yeah, that's hard. That takes a long time. Yeah, wow.
But I think you have to start, because if you don't, you won't.
Well, that was one of the genesis of our little school blog, was to at least, because my weekly email gets about 4,400 subscribers around the country, a few around the world. And I try to put lots of different things on there, you know, whether it's pro this, anti this, or whatever it might be, you know. But I've been thinking about what, there's got to be things that are more effective.
See, I think one of the things that you and other people miss that is terribly important. In 1970, in this country, the best school systems in this country were large urban school districts. Here we are, 40 years later, there isn't one large urban school district in America that most people would say is even average.
Yeah.
Now, what caused the best of our schools that happened to be all urban school districts mm-hmm. to now become the worst?
In 40 years.
And what's in 40 years?
Yeah.
And what is the consequence for our society of that?
Yes.
Now, I'd suggest to you that these urban school districts are characterized by non-Caucasian students. Mm-hmm. They have the highest percentage of non-Caucasian students. Mm-hmm. And the Democratic South and its attitudes towards race has changed some, but I would also say that the other political party pretty well demonstrates their attitudes towards gays, lesbians, blacks, Hispanics, Asians, etc. And so we haven't done anything as a society to correct what's going on in our urban centers. Mm-hmm. We now have Madison, Wisconsin, as we are having this conversation, more than 50% of the students who go to the Madison public schools come from families whose income level is below the poverty level.
Exactly. Yep.
And it isn't every year it goes up. And the same thing is true in other urban school systems. Mm-hmm. And we have done nothing to correct that. But we all talk about the quality of schools. Well, if you take the 25 or 50 or 75 biggest school districts, this society can't continue to be economically growing without correcting for the evils of that poverty, mm-hmm. the impacts. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anybody, no one at the university, no one at the city level in this city is saying anything. There's no debate about the biggest problem here, which is poverty mm-hmm. for children. Now, you can talk about all these other issues about schools, but this problem will more determine what's going to happen in the next 50 years than all the rest of these problems added up. And there's no discussion about it. Mm-hmm.
True.
And there's no moral outrage about it.
So what do you suggest? You have experience. What can be done to address the urban economic base and poverty, as you say, poverty, I mean.
Well, one of the things you could do is you could say any school, any elementary school building that has 40% or more students of poverty level mm-hmm. has to have school for 11 months a year.
Right.
One of the things, all the research says mm-hmm. that if you don't go to school and you come from a family below the poverty level, that your reading and math scores will drop from 1 to 2 grades in the summertime for poor kids. Because your kids and mine, we will send to summer activities so their grades don't drop off in reading and math. But these poor kids, it happens. So if we want to keep those children progressing, we're going to have summer school for them.
Non-agrarian schedules, yes.
Yes, we're going to have
them. Right.
And we ought to, have a big debate about that right now. And then we ought to have if the Madison School District's going to deal with this, it ought to take the real problems it has, like the learning,
the reading and all that stuff.
Well, the learning styles and the achievement styles in these poverty schools. And we ought to come up with, if those schools will have lower achievement scores. Mm-hmm. You tell me the income levels of the kids going there, and I can tell you who's going to succeed. I mean, who's going to do well on standardized achievement tests. Well, if we're going to do something for those kids, we ought to require that if those schools are at this level in 7 years or 10, that they're this much better. And if they aren't this much better, then we ought to start putting these schools into receivership.
Mm-hmm. To close them down. Yeah.
Receivership to say, all right, you don't get any longer to make these decisions. Somebody, the society's going to make these decisions. Mm-hmm. But, we're not talking about that.
No.
But we have to start talking about this, that thing. And that you're not going to solve this urban poverty problem by a few voucher schools.
No, I agree with that. That is not going to solve the problem, though.
But if we want to solve this, and if we don't want to solve it, we're going to be a second-rate economic power.
Absolutely.
All the other industrial countries, have at least 20-year-day longer school year. Many of them 30 and 40 day longer school years than America.
Definitely.
That Japan has no public school boards. They don't have school boards in Japan.
Yeah. So talk about that.
Well, Douglas MacArthur set up the Japanese education system after World War II. They eliminated the public school board. The state government hires all the teachers. They have one national pay schedule. And they have one national curriculum.
There's been a lot of controversy over that here with the Common Core and obviously the federal mandates, state things, all that. Is that an answer?
It probably isn't an answer here, because Japan only has 0.1% of non-Japanese population in their country.
Right.
They teach culture in the fourth grade in the Japanese schools. Can you imagine what would happen if we started teaching culture?
In
the fifth grade in American schools?
Oh, there's plenty of battles on that already.
I think
school boards are maybe part of the challenge in some way.
Well, I think they are part of the challenge.
Yeah.
But I'm just pointing out that in Japan they don't have them.
Sure.
And most people think that the Japanese school system is at least equal to ours.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe superior.
Right, exactly. Huh. So if we started from scratch, so we want to have public education, absolutely. Is it a state function? Is it city function? Is it, these districts that cover like ours and a little bit of Oregon, a little bit of Fitchburg and, a little bit of town of Madison, all that. Is that the right way to do it, or how should they be organized?
Well, you have all these school districts that were set up when this was an agricultural society.
Right.
And where probably the same standards wouldn't today make as much sense. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, we also, there are a lot of functions of schools that really aren't education.
Of course.
I mean, school lunch, personnel practices, you know, bidding on supplies, etc. You can go down the list and probably at least 20% of the school expenditures aren't educational policy,
right, right.
Or not very significant. So why don't we require counties, cities, towns, and villages and school districts to integrate those functions into entities that would save money on an economic basis.
And all right. That stuff, right?
You know, plowing the school district sidewalks.
Oh, I think about that when I see the lawnmower here at that school, of course.
So yeah. There are a whole bunch of those kinds of things that I think you could do and save a lot of money.
What would the politics have to be to do that, do you think, today? I mean, I've thought about that. We have 72 counties in Wisconsin. It seems
well, you got at least 15 or 20 counties that aren't big enough to be efficient.
I know.
But some of this is, you probably can't get that done. Mm-hmm. But you ought to have the debate about it.
Right.
So the population ought to have the debate to decide. Now, if the public wants to keep their small school districts, mm-hmm. and their small towns and villages, well, then maybe we aren't going to give them a state shared revenue. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're going to have to pay for that. Maybe if it costs them more, maybe they're going to have to pay
for that differential,
the incremental difference locally if they want. Mm-hmm. But we've never had any of those debates.
No.
There's no statute that requires any expenditure by a school board above $500 to go to beds. So most school districts who paint buildings in the summer go down to the local hardware store and buy the paint. Mm-hmm. Now, that local hardware store is going to cost them more to buy the paint than it would if they went to bid on it.
Sure.
Well, you know, are there two sides to this argument? Absolutely. It's taxes from the local
taxpayers, of course.
But it's also state money coming
right
there.
Right.
So, you know, what's the push and shove here? But there's no we haven't had that debate.
So it sounds like a bully pulpit that's willing to go to the fairs and go to all the events and start talking about these issues is the journey of a 1,000-mile
right.
journey. Yeah.
Well, and you have utilities mm-hmm. that have guaranteed service areas. So the Madison
cronyism, yeah.
MGE mm-hmm. has the highest.
Highest rates, so
any place in the state.
Don't get me started.
No, but my point is, why don't we exempt the public schools and the university and all government from buying their from a utility
right,
and have them go to bid
exactly.
with one utility statewide
right.
for the low bidder?
Right.
Now, that put MG&E out of business.
Yes, it would.
I mean, but, you know, But either we believe in a free economy
right.
or we
don't. Yeah, we either have cronyism or I agree.
And so, we've never had any of these debates.
Not at all, no.
And these aren't, I mean, I think these have at least as much policy consequences as whether we ought to eliminate collective bargaining for the K-12 teachers or not.
No, of course, it sets a tone for the whole thing.
Yeah. You know, so, and I think the public would welcome,
of course,
that kind of debate. But the power structure doesn't want it.
That's the same in Washington.
Well, but the power structure doesn't want. They kind of come to a common agreement. You know, Gormain and I.
Of course, yeah, when we all operate, and here we are. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Wow. Interesting.
And I think Wisconsin used to have a reputation for being rather innovative. Mm-hmm. I think we've kind of lost our way about that.
This conversation with Morris Andrews was recorded in August 2013 and published on schoolinfosystem.org.